Well, the bite is on. We heard it on the radio. All-you-can-eat shrimp. Come and get 'em. And so, mouths watering in anticipation, we stampede across the floor and out the door for a meal of that delicious protein. But wait, how can they afford to feed us all-we-can-eat shrimp?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 680th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Singapore who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Nikki James on the boards and phones. Hello, Nikki.
Hello.
Folks, this from Bubba in the movie Forrest Gump. Shrimp is the fruit of the sea. You can barbecue it, boil it, broil it, bake it, saute it. These shrimp kebabs, shrimp creole, shrimp gumbo, pan-fried, deep-fried, stir-fried. There's pineapple shrimp, lemon shrimp, coconut shrimp, pepper shrimp, shrimp soup, shrimp stew, shrimp salad, shrimp and potatoes, shrimp burger, and shrimp sandwich. And so on, and so on. And so the bite is on. Anthropologists tell us that way back in history, we developed a very special relationship with seafood that quite literally helped us grow out of our primitive minds. Given how much we benefit from seafood, it's quite natural that our appetite for it has grown with the size of our population. As a consequence of our hunger, we now are rapidly eating our way down the marine food chain and now find that fish that were once considered inedible are now delicacies. Friends, we're talking peanut butter and jellyfish sandwiches here. And so with so few fish left in the sea, we wonder, how can they afford to feed us all we can eat shrimp? Well, that's a question of the day, and here to help us work out an answer, we have Tara Skresko, who is author of Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. Tara, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks so much, Michael.
Bottom Feeder? Where'd you get the name Bottom Feeder?
Bottom Feeder. That's a good question. There were a lot of grim titles that came to mind, like The Empty Seas, that kind of thing, but I wanted something catchy. Uh-huh. When I mentioned it to David Suzuki, who's a big environmental campaigner up in Canada, he said, is it about lawyers?
Mm-hmm. Lawyers, right? Bottom feeders, okay. That's pretty good. Well, bottom feeder, of course, is a fish that feeds on the bottom of the sea.
Yeah, and the idea behind bottom feeder is that right now we eat at the upper echelons of the food chain. Mm-hmm. We really like big sort of steak-like fish at the center of our plate,
the
like swordfish, like marlin, yeah, like tuna, that kind of thing. And the idea behind bottom feeder is I'm trying to encourage people to eat a little lower down the marine food chain, things that are a lot more abundant in the ocean. I'm a big fan of flavorful fish like mackerel and sardines. There's a fish called anchoveta, which is caught by the ton in South America right now.
Oh.
And we tend to grind these things up right now and feed them to pigs. We feed them to salmon, farm salmon off the coast of Chile and British Columbia, and shrimp as well.
That's right. So we're taking those fish that are very rich in the omega-3s, the oils, and feeding them to farm fish, right?
Exactly, which is pretty illogical when you think about it. And the big fish that we tend to love, unfortunately, happen to be the most chock full of toxins,
right,
whether it's mercury or PCBs, fire retardant, basically.
Collected all the bad stuff. Well, you know what? When I saw your book, I thought, oh, wonderful. Here's a person who traveled the world's marine food chains, eating his way up and down that food chain, and to write a book about eating seafood. And I thought it would be a wonderful adventure story as well as a teaching moment, if you will. So you must have had some great adventures in pulling all of this information together. So can you share with us a little adventure?
Oh, sure, for sure. I love going to Japan. They're one of the big... leading seafood consuming nation in the world. One in every 10 fish eaten in the world is consumed in Japan. And they have this amazing market called Tsukiji Market in the center of Tokyo. It's been around for decades in the same location. And they have this amazing tuna auction every morning where they auction off these, you know, up to one-ton bluefin tuna. And they're these beautiful fish that are come from all over the world. Some come from the coasts of Nova Scotia. Some come are farmed in Iran now. They come from Australian waters as well. And they can fetch prices of up to $170,000 per fish. They're kind of subdivided in the market and sent off to the sushi bars of Tokyo, where you end up paying, you know, 20 to 40 bucks a pop for two pieces of this sushi.
For a
just
sliver
the best
of
in the world.
Yeah, a sliver of sushi, yeah.
Now, the problem with all this is I went to Japan and realized that, you know, you see these fish, they've come from all over the world, and you realize what a globalized industry seafood has become. And the bluefin in particular are going through really rough times right now. The Western stock is currently threatened by the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. Mm-hmm. They're just going into their spawning period right now. So, I mean, as much as I love seeing all of these things as I traveled the world, you know, whether it was being on a Portuguese sardine boat or seeing the shrimp ponds in India, it left me quite worried about what we're doing to the oceans.
So the question really then is becomes one of sustainability and how on earth are we ever going to maintain this when you look at what's happening with the wildlife in the sea. Take us back to the beginning, though, and that very special relationship humankind developed with fish way back in the primitive times when we were running around with primitive brains and how seafood really changed the nature of human beings.
Yeah, a lot of research has been done on the presence of omega-3s in the food chain in the last couple of decades. It's interesting. A lot of scientists believe that omega-3 fatty acids are essential for brain development, which is why you find DHA, which is a kind of omega-3 fatty acid, in infant formula now. We've basically managed to strip omega-3 fatty acids from the food chain, and a lot of people think that the lack of omega-3 fatty acids is leading to what's called metabolic syndrome, which includes things like diabetes, depression, etc. All the things, you know, that happens when societies adopt a Western diet.
Mm-hmm.
Now, omega-3s are really rich in the oceanic food chain. They essentially come from plankton.
So they come from the very bottom of
the
food chain.
They come from the very bottom.
Right.
Bottom feeder, once again. And a lot of recent anthropological evidence points to the fact that humans, we used to think that humans sort of evolved on the savannah, you know, hunting for big game, that kind of thing. We came down from the treetops looking for big game. But actually, there's a correlation between the development of the human brain about 2 million years ago, and again, exponentially about 400,000 years ago, with seafood consumption. They've found that the most intelligent hominids, early humans, were eating a lot of seafood, particularly catfish in Africa and shellfish. And they found the bones, fossilized bones and shells, that provide this evidence. So I'm making the case in bottom feeder that we do need omega-3s. There are vegetarian sources of them, but so much of the world relies on seafood. And if we consume it intelligently, if we don't strip the upper levels of the oceanic food chain, I think we can live in harmony with the oceans
and still keep
our brains working.
To that great extent. Well, let me ask you this. It seems like we're going to have to take a quick break here, but I'd like to go back to the omega-3s for just a moment, because it seems like we have stripped the omega-3s not only out of the ocean but out of our land food chain as well. Because when we took animals off of grass and put them onto grain, we took them off of omega-3s and put them onto omega-6s. And thus, it seems like we're essentially starving ourselves for the omega-3s that are in seafood.
Yeah, that's exactly true. In particular, I mean, if you have sort of free-range chickens, their eggs tend to be really high in omega-3s because they're eating grubs, they're eating things besides grain. And now, ironically, we have to sort of enhance our eggs with omega-3s. So we're artificially restoring things that we've stripped from the food chain. And, omega-3s are, it's a big story. And, you know, people talk a lot about fads and say, oh, you know, it was vitamin C, you know, right. Or there was cholesterol, that kind of thing. I don't think the omega-3 thing is a fad. There's a lot of evidence piling up that this is a real issue. And for me, the solution has been, you know, two or three times a week, eating things like sardines or mackerel or herring, that kind of thing. They're all really rich in omega-3s and low in contaminants.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, today we're talking about the food in our sea, the wild food and the farmed food, and the value that food brings to us. And how on earth can we keep eating all we can eat shrimp when there are so few fish left in the sea? With Terrace Gresco and you right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, the bite is on. Heard it on the radio, folks. All you can eat shrimp, come and get them. But how on earth can they afford to feed us all we can eat shrimp? Because I can eat a lot. I bet you can, too. And food is expensive, but not shrimp. So why is it expensive? And that's the question we're working with today. And we're working with Terrace Gresco, who is the author of Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. Terrace traveled the world and ate his way up and down the marine food chain, learning a little bit about what makes the seafood tick and how we're managing it or not manage it, as the case may be. And we don't seem to be managing it all that well. Terrace, it seems like we always consider the oceans to be the commons, in which anybody who could throw a hook and a line and a sinker in the water could catch fish, and it was free protein and great source of free protein, right?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and in a less populated world, that was a fine idea. Unfortunately, I mean, there's so many sort of trawlers out there, industrial-sized trawlers that can really do a number on stripping the ocean floor, that it's not the commons anymore. I love the idea of, you know, I love the principle of being able to throw a hook into the water and pull out whatever you want and feed yourself. And there's a lot of arguments to be made for protecting small-scale fishermen. That should be a right. But unfortunately, that too many people have taken advantage of that commons idea. One of the best ideas we have these days is to set aside areas of the ocean that are like national parks on the land, mm-hmm. where the fish are protected.
Well, let's go back a little bit and let's talk about how, you know, we went from the hook, line, and sinker to the industrialization. And tell people a little bit about what that really means with respect to how we harvest fish these days.
Yeah, well, I guess it all started in the 14th century with the with the invention of the trawl. And this was controversial in England at the time when it was invented. People were, they realized that by dragging these trawls behind small vessels, and often they were actually horse-drawn on the side of rivers, that they were raking everything that lived on the bottom of the seashore, or along rivers, and rather, when they were catching things with nets and hooks, that was sort of sustainable and renewable. But when you were ripping up the bottom in order to get the maximum haul, you're causing huge problems. So actually in England at the time, they banned these trawls. Now, what's that was the beginning of the industrialization. Of course, when you add gasoline, you add these big-scale ships, distant water fleets. China has a lot of these now. The Russians have them all over the world. Their potential to strip the bottom of the ocean all over the globe is enormous, and they do a huge amount of harm.
When you say stripping the bottom, it's kind of like clear-cutting a forest, right?
Yeah, it is. Basically, if you look at they've put cameras down there, and if you look at what's on the sea bottom before these ships come along, it's a pretty rich biome. There's little eyes poking out everywhere, among all the rocks. And these things come along, these giant bottom trawls, which are extremely heavy, and they rake the bottom. They've got rollers, rock hoppers, and all this technology, and they just strip it. And there's nothing left afterwards, except gradually very primitive forms of life return. So you get things like on the Atlantic coast, these carpets of sea squirts, which are these terrible, inedible organisms that cover the bottom and prevent anything else from growing. So, what we're doing basically is through lots of different avenues, but bottom trawling is one of the biggest ones, we're causing the oceans to revert to a much more primitive stage, a stage that won't feed us anymore.
So, and essentially, not only are we killing the life, but we're also altering the terrain of the ocean floor as well, correct?
That's true. Which is why anybody who is into this issue supports certain kinds of fishing. There are forms of trawling, like midwater trawls that don't rake the bottom. And there are trawl nets that allow the non-targeted species to escape. They have little hatches, that kind of thing. So, for example, when you're trawling for shrimp, you can do a pretty good job of excluding those things. There are, even though there is a lot of bycatch, a lot of other species caught in most shrimp fisheries, there is technology that allows you to avoid the worst damage.
And you want to avoid the worst damage because if you don't, you really destroy the whole ecosystem in fishing for everybody else. But how on earth do you control countries that have these giant trawlers and they're fishing international waters? Who's there to say, hey, what are you doing? Who's there to stop that? Nobody.
Well, there is no international agency out there controlling that at all. I think, bottom line, the best thing that we can do, I've talked about these marine parks, which would be a great way to start preserving areas. You don't allow any economic activity, including drilling for oil, in those areas because you consider them sacred sources of, this is where fish and shellfish spawn. This is a source of food for us and our kids and our grandkids. Another thing that we can do, though, is what the European Union has been doing, and they're insisting on traceability.
I'm going to hold that. I'd like to pick that up toward the end here, but
sure.
let me go back to this notion of how good we have become at catching the wild fish in the sea, because even if you go out in a little tiny skiff off the coast and fish for salmon, they have fish finders and they have depth finders and they know exactly where the fish hang out and where the holes are. And boy, there's not much guesswork left anymore, is there?
It's not very sporting. It's basically an industrialized activity using tools that were developed for international warfare, going after creatures with brains the size of peas, if that big. The deck is kind of stacked against them. And there's not too much honor in spotting a shoal of sardines. They use spotter planes now to catch the bluefin tuna.
Yeah, I had a friend
we're very capable of stripping the oceans of all remaining protein if we want.
I had a good friend who was flying helicopters looking for swordfish.
Right.
And so we have become very good at fishing the wild fish, and we fished the wild fish almost to extinction. He'll live here on the coast here on the brilliant waters of the Monterey Bay.
Yeah.
And there's not much fish not much local fish.
Yeah, you go to the, you go to the great aquarium there with doing a fantastic job of alerting people to what's ethical to eat.
Right. But, you know, you go to a local fish market, and there's not much local fish there.
Yeah, okay. As I say, it really has become globalized. And perhaps the biggest story going on, it's not talked about very much, is how much of our fish now comes from fish farming. A lot of people say, well, you know, my fish market still seems to have tons of fish. What's the problem? If you start asking the fishmongers where the stuff is coming from, you'll realize that in the case of shrimp, for example, 85% of it is imported, mostly from China now, although a lot comes from Indonesia, Thailand, and India. And what I found when I looked at that food chain was particularly shocking.
Sure. And that's what we're going to pick up when we come back from the break. But there's one quick thing I wanted to ask you. What happens when you ask about fresh fish?
Fresh fish. Most of the fish is frozen at some point. Mm-hmm. The sushi, by law, is frozen in order to, because it's consumed raw, is frozen to kill off parasites.
I always thought that the most frightening thing in the world is fresh fish, because the only thing that is meant by fresh fish is that it hasn't been frozen. So fresh fish could be old fish that just hasn't been frozen. Am I wrong?
It could be. It could be. They're not. I mean, most people can detect fish.
They can smell it, right?
It's so perishable, fish. And really fresh fish. You don't want really fresh fish, because most of it goes into, becomes incredibly hard. It goes into this sort of form of rigor mortis for about 24 hours after it's caught.
It has to be aged. Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Terrace Gresko, author of Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. When we come back, farmed fish. Yum. Right back. Do stay tuned. Well, folks, we've become such good fisher persons that we've caught most of the fish in the sea, or so it would seem. And even though we've caught most of the fish, they can still feed us all the shrimp that we want at one small little tiny price. So how on earth can they afford to feed us all the shrimp we can eat? And in spite of the fact that we've caught most of the fish in the sea? Well, that's the question we're working with Terrace Gresko, author of Bottom Feeder, and you, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1980. We're going to pick up Jim, who has a question comment for Terrace. Jim, go ahead.
Yeah, I've been living here for 36 years up in Felton, and I'm a long-time sport fisherman. I haven't been fishing lately, but we recently took a trip to Big Sur, and we drove across the Pajaro River, and I can't believe how badly degraded that river is, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think what it does is it, you know, we have two really important industries, actually three, and, you know, one is the local agriculture, and the other two are sport fishing and food producing, and it looks to me like that Pajaro River has been really destroyed, and basically the habitat, the steelhead, and the salmon run destroyed.
Well, let's talk with Terrace. Terrace, you're on the East Coast. Same conditions there, probably, right?
Well, it's actually a lot different. I mean, the rivers were stripped here a long time ago of their native salmon populations. I grew up on the West Coast. I know British Columbia and Washington State, especially. And what's nice about the West is that there are still native populations of Pacific salmon and steelhead, which is a salmonid. Unfortunately, the rivers are being degraded. Even up north in British Columbia, the Fraser River sockeye runs, which are huge and a source of food for the native people up there, collapsed last year, causing huge concern. And your problems in California have to do with irrigation, lack of water. I mean, the salmon runs started disappearing around the time of the gold rush back then. A lot of rivers have been artificially repopulated. What's happening up north, and which we should all be concerned about, is that the industrial aquaculture undertaken by Europeans, Norwegians, has been set up on the coast of British Columbia, and it's also happening in Chile. And in Canada, they're eliminating local runs of wild salmon because it's basically kind of like battery chickens. They're setting up this industrial operation with up to 1 million salmon confined into these pens, which are about the size of 2 or 3 tennis courts. And they get these things called sea lice, which they then pass on to the wild salmon, the the sea pens are located at the mouths of
and
rivers.
They have, get this, what? Sea life?
Sea lice.
Lice.
Yeah, oh. Nasty little parasites that eat the skin of the wild salmon. So once again, it's evidence of this industrialization of the whole seafood market and the globalization. I'm sympathetic to what's happening in California, but I'm torn up about what's happening in British Columbia, because that's a huge source of food for the native people up there.
Okay, Jim, you have a quick follow-up?
Oh, I just wanted to say, actually, I grew up on the East Coast. I grew up on the Merrimack River, Massachusetts.
Right.
Yeah. And that's a greatly degraded habitat, and it's actually been partially restored. And there's a very, 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 very small salmon run and a very small striped bass run. But the problem now is getting past the dams, and they still have quite a bit of urban pollution, runoff and treated wastewater and things like that that impacts the environment. But I think we can do something about Pajaro. I think, you know, with some better irrigation practices, you know, reduced use of pesticides and salt fertilizers and some barriers, you know, like land strips, riparian corridors, we could have both agriculture and fishing too. And I don't want to see one sacrificed at the hands of the other. I support both.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call, Jim. Really appreciate it. So what you talk about then is how we can't afford to eat so much seafood now. In an era where most of the wild seafood is gone, of course, is that we farm it. How do we farm seafood, Terrence Gresko?
Yeah, well,
you just talked about pens of wild salmon with millions of salmon in a little tiny confined space.
Exactly, yeah. We tend to do it on an industrial scale now, unfortunately. I'm not against farmed seafood. I think that it's essential. It's an old practice. It goes back a couple of thousand years. The Chinese were faming for farming carp a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Tilapia, for example, not the most exciting fish to eat, but very sustainable. It can be raised on sort of a vegetarian diet, so you're not diminishing the amount of wild protein out there. Even shrimp can be raised sustainably, and I really support the domestic shrimp farms in the United States. Particularly freshwater prawns, which are a great choice.
There's something I wanted to talk about in reading your book. What I notice here is that we have really, here in the United States, we have really refined how we will allow agriculture or aquaculture to exist. It must confine to some very strict environmental standards. But it's easy for us to export the dirtiness elsewhere.
Which is what I did in Bottom Feeder. I followed sort of the food chain from the local all-you-can-eat shrimp restaurant back to where the shrimp came from. And I chose India. I went to a place called Tamil Nadu in India, which when I was there was still reeling from the effects of that tsunami in 2004. Basically, yeah, I mean, you've externalized a lot of the environmental impacts. And when it comes to shrimp farming on an industrial scale can be a very dirty business. I visited some of the ponds. First of all, you wouldn't want to take a sip from those ponds, let alone you would want to wade around in them. They're full of antibiotics, things like chloramphenicol, which causes aplastic anemia. Now, this is not only bad for the people who live around there. I was kind of shocked by the people who are the farmers who live close by these shrimp ponds who don't want them there are often suffering from all kinds of digestive and skin ailments. But those antibiotics and contaminants show up in the shrimp that's sampled for inspection that comes into the United States. Louisiana, for example, and Mississippi are quite aggressive about inspecting imported shrimp because they have their own wild shrimp industry, which I think we should support. And they find that about 1 in 10 shrimp sampled have detectable levels of these carcinogens.
Let's talk about why the shrimp farmers use these chemicals in their farming. Why is that necessary?
Shrimp are kind of hard to raise. First of all, they're cannibals. They eat each other. You got to get the salinity of the water right. And then they tend, because you have so many of them together in the pond in order to make it profitable, they come down with all these viruses and bacteria, like black splinter disease, white spot virus, something called brown gills. So in order to kill off the pathogens, you have to dose the ponds with high levels of antibiotics and other chemicals. And that's what we're seeing showing up in the shrimp. The Mississippi State University bought 13 brands of imported shrimp, and they found 162 species of bacteria in the samples. And their conclusion was that you should be cooking ready-to-eat shrimp that you buy from the supermarket.
Folks, this is the Food Chain, Michael Olson. All you can eat shrimp. Yum. Right back, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080 with Terrace Gresko. Well, you know, it just doesn't make any sense, but somehow it's true. We've fished all the fish out of the sea, and yet we can eat all we can eat shrimp out down at the local restaurant. How is that possible? Well, it's possible, of course, because we've learned how to farm seafood. And we have, it seems to be there's two different kinds of aquaculture going on here. There's some good kinds and there's some bad kinds. Terrace Gresko, what are the good kinds?
There are kinds of aquaculture, fish farming, that actually help the ocean. Oysters, mussels, abalone, big in California. Mm-hmm. They reduce the amount of plankton in the ocean. They eat plankton, or in the case of abalone, they eat kelp, which prevents harmful algae blooms, which we're seeing a lot of because we're pouring all of this fertilizer into the ocean. So
nitrogen on the land and algae blooms in the ocean.
Exactly, yeah. And the scary thing is we're seeing these huge dead zones off the coast now. There's about 150 of them around the world. There's one off the coast of Oregon, which is enormous, and they're caused by these blooms. The dead algae sinks to the bottom and
suffocates everything,
yeah. So, I mean, shellfish aquaculture is really good. I think there is some fantastic, you can even raise salmon intelligently in what's called closed containment systems. And this involves getting the salmon off of the coasts where all of the feed and contaminants tend to be passed on to wild species. You can raise these things inland. I've been to farms 100 miles from the coast where people are raising coho salmon, for example, which they sell to great restaurants for a huge profit, and they're doing it in tanks and, you know, in their backyard. If we want to do it, if we're willing to make a little more of an investment, we can raise things like tilapia. There's shrimp being raised in northern Alberta. In some cases, but what people like is the low cost of farmed seafood. And that kind of seafood, cheap seafood, is bad seafood at this point.
Cheap
seafood
isn't.
Used to be, what's that?
I said cheap food isn't.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and it's funny because we used to think of seafood as sort of, you know, a low cost option. For our grandparents, it was. I'm saying to people now, if you're eating seafood, look at it as kind of a luxury, something that you do a few times a month, and be willing to pay a premium. By paying a premium, you're supporting local fishermen, local fish farmers, and that all-you-can-eat shrimp deal at the local chain restaurant is not a good deal for your health or for the long-term health of the world.
So how do they feed us all-we-can-eat shrimp?
That's an interesting question. I'd like to think when I go to a shrimp restaurant that Forrest Gump or somebody out in, you know, the Gulf of Mexico is gathering these things up. But the big chain restaurants about 20 years ago decided that Forrest Gump and company weren't delivering uniform enough shrimp. And they started rejecting the shrimp produced by domestic producers. And they decided that it was better to get the shrimp from a farm in India or Thailand or
because
China
it was
now.
Uniform and it was there
uniform.
And it was dependable and you didn't have to rely on Forrest Gump.
Exactly. And the shrimp is now a commodity. It's like pork bellies. You know, it's traded on these international markets. And it's a lot easier to get this frozen stuff from abroad. Unfortunately, it's hard to find the local stuff these days. About 85% of the shrimp.
So when you go to a restaurant and get all you can eat shrimp, you're almost guaranteed it's coming from a giant fish or shrimp farm someplace.
Yeah, yeah. Well, actually, they kind of the shrimp farmers in India and Thailand aren't making a lot of money. They bear all of the risk. There's a giant company called the CP Group, which owns all the 7-Elevens in Thailand, all the KFCs in China. These Chinese brothers from Thailand who control most of the international shrimp trade. So they're making a lot of the money, as are, of course, the retailers and restaurant chains who sell the stuff in the United States.
So I read where, you know, a restaurant chain will buy salmon or shrimp for 25 cents a pound and sell it for $25 a pound.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. What are the all-you-can-eat deals? It's like $14.99, that kind of thing. I can only eat so much of that stuff before I burst.
So that then you can only eat only so much of it, and then it's essentially they're buying it for a quarter a pound and selling it for $25 a pound. So for seafood restaurants are making a ton of money.
Yeah, as are the intermediaries, like the CP Group, as I mentioned.
So that's
the farmers who aren't making a lot of money.
That's a lot like what is happening with domestic cattle industry. The cattle ranchers aren't making the money, but it's the middlemen who are making the big bucks. And the cattlemen kind of end up like the shrimp farmers of Thailand.
Exactly, yeah.
Where they're bearing all the risk and only sharing a little in the rewards.
Yeah, the big companies have got it all worked out. It's funny that. They say that I did the math. If you added up all the shrimp that's imported into the U.S. a year, it would make a volume of shrimp 108 stories, like the size of the Sears Tower in Chicago. I think only the first two or three stories of that are domestic shrimp. So you're almost guaranteed to be eating the imported stuff. I love shrimp. I like the sort of sweet saltiness of it, and I still go out of my way to eat northern shrimp, as it's called, which is caught off the coast of Maine and Quebec. Oregon spot prawns are fantastic. It's really good protein. At this point, though, I just don't buy the cheap stuff. You know, it's like
you don't go for the all-you-can-eat treat.
Yeah.
Well, when we get back, I want to ask, to me, what the most important question is: what happens to the omega-3s in farm shrimp? Can we still get omega-3s? So, right back, and finally, the big question of all, of course, is how do we eat ethically in a world of vanishing seafood? With Teres Gresko, right back. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're concluding Bottom Feeder with Teres Gresko. Teres, are we becoming bottom feeders?
Yeah, well, we can't avoid it because we have sort of stripped the oceans of some of the bigger fish at the top of the food chain. They say 90% of the big fish, the swordfish, the tuna, and sharks have already been removed from the ocean.
So I guess what's left then are the bottom feeders and the farmed fish, right?
Yeah, more and more. The conclusion of the book is not to avoid fish and farmed fish. It's just to find ways to do it a little more intelligently so the oceans can continue to be sources of food and beauty and leisure.
Well, do you think that we can? I mean, given the fact that there are nations out there that are running these giant bottom scoopers that just leveling the bottom of the seafloor and taking everything and indiscriminately taking everything. Do you think we can develop a sustainable ocean fishery?
We might just have to, and it might be sort of beyond our power to control. A lot of this is determined by the price of gasoline. Every fisherman I talked to around the world was constantly complaining about the price of gas. And the economics of these distant water fisheries and the bottom trawlers don't work so well if gas is really expensive. So that might be the interesting thing that develops over the next 5 or 6 years. In terms of solutions, though, I don't think there's anything better than setting aside parts of our coastline along the Americas and setting aside marine protected areas.
Well, we've done a great job of that here in the United States. As I mentioned earlier, we're very cognizant of the need to take good care of our environment. But what we do is export our filth by buying it from other countries that are not too concerned about what goes on with their environment. And that seems to be where we're getting our all-we-can-eat shrimp, or am I missing something?
No, you've got it exactly right. This is a big problem, externalizing the sort of impacts of industrialized fish farming. And it's really hitting people in China hard. Unfortunately, I don't think that we're deriving any benefit from it, because the food that we're eating as a result of this is actually pretty filthy. Only about, I think it's 1.59% of all the imported seafood gets inspected by the FDA. So there may be this illusion that that the gatekeepers are watching over this supply, but that's not the case.
So there is nobody really watching over. And one of the things we understand, of course, is that some of the shrimp from China has been banned because it has carcinogens in it. But what's happening with shrimp is the same thing that happens with honey. They take the honey and ship it to Taiwan or Singapore, and they slap a new label on it and then ship it here, and it comes in as being from someplace else.
Yeah, we could really use a lot better traceability in North America when it comes to seafood, and people are working on that. But until that point, I'd say if you're going for shrimp, go to the seashore and support a local fisherman. Find your local Forrest Gump if you can, and ask people, ask questions in restaurants. Where does this come from? Is it farmed? Is it wild? Is it domestic especially? Most domestic shrimp is pretty good.
Seafood with its fisherman's face on it.
Yeah, if you can do it. It often requires a trip. It often requires a few questions, but maybe for the time being, that's how we should be looking at our seafood, as something we really value rather than something that we go to the mall to shovel into our face.
So the most important thing we as consumers can do, the single most important thing, what, give us one thing that we can do that will really help.
I'd say, people ask me that, I say avoid farmed imported shrimp, and I say the same thing for salmon too, because there's this kind of illusion that that's a safe fish. Only eat wild salmon.
Amen.
And that in moderation.
Okay, folks, so we've been talking with Terrace Gresco, author of Bottom Feeder, How to Eat Ethically in a World of Vanishing Seafood. How can they sell us all-we-can-eat shrimp? They can do so by selling us some pretty scary fish. Thank you very much for tuning in. This has been The Food Chain. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio. Thanks, Terrace.
A pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
Yeah.